Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman. On this week's episode, we'll be talking about the myth of the British decline, the 12th of July parades in Northern Ireland, and the regrettable rise of the man hug. First, Britain seems to be relapsing into another bout of declinism, writes Professor Robert Toombs in his Spectator cover piece this week. From terror attacks to the Grenfell Tower disaster, election upsets to our looming Brexit, the news is being seen by some as a sign of Britain's downward trajectory in the world. It's time to snap out of it, says Professor Toombs, who joins me now along with Fraser Nelson. So, Robert, lots of British people, if you ask them, would say that this country is going through a really miserable period, and you list in your piece some of the examples of that, but then hold it in tension with the idea that Britain is actually not declining.
Well, I guess the main thing is short and long-term changes. It's clear we're obviously in a bit of a pickle at the moment, and it's happened very quickly and unexpectedly. Personally, I think that's part of a much more general political volatility that's hitting the whole of the Western world. In that sense, we're in rather a similar position to our French friends and neighbours, the Americans, of course, and a lot of other countries who've suddenly found that their political situation is far less stable than they thought, and that the outcomes are very much more unpredictable and change much more quickly. So I think we have had that in the last election campaign, clearly. And things that were simply unfortunate coincidences have added to a sense of short-term difficulty. Now, if you think that this is part of a long-term trend, that's what I'm really criticising. After all, things that are sudden shocks are rarely, of course they can be, but they're rarely of huge importance. We get over these things, and usually anyway. But what is much more important, I think, are long-term changes. And there I think we're in a much better and more solid position, economically and politically. You know, that you don't change the nature of a country, its society, its economy, and even its things like its military force, its international influence, are not changed overnight. Or if they are, they pretty quickly come back to the norm. Unless, of course, there is a real disaster. And I don't think we're quite in that position.
Fraser, could it be the case that the political chaos in particular that we've been experiencing in this country, and as Robert says, across the Western world, is actually good in the long term, that it creates a sort of creative destruction?
I personally am happier that we're in the situation we are now, rather than Theresa May having a large 150-seat majority. If that had happened, I think a rather uninspiring manifesto would have set the agenda for the next 5 to 10 years, and would have been a rather boring and uncreative period. I also think there's a great tendency for people to confuse the state of the government with the state of the country. They can look at Westminster, they can say, what a shambles, look at this, Theresa May's lost her majority, Britain must be going to the dogs. But those two things are by no means the same. I mean, in America, you can have a government shutdown and still, the economy does very, very well. And in Britain, I mean, you can just read Professor Toombs's piece to see the incredible achievements. We've got unemployment at a 40-year low, income inequality at a 30-year low, crime at the lowest level since surveys began. Pretty good record for a country supposedly in crisis. I guess the theme of his article is that the Brits are very good at doing ourselves down. We love to think the country's going to the dogs, in spite of all the evidence that is not.
So could it be the case that actually the British are very good at doing themselves down, at being humble about their achievements as a country, which actually propels this country on to further greatness because it's never fully satisfied?
That's an ingenious view. There's nothing wrong with humility, and I think few of us like the kind of bluster that you sometimes get from, you know, super patriots, whether here or elsewhere. But I think if it's taken too far, and I think at the moment it is, I think it can do us harm. And I think it's because we seem to have some difficulty in working out our true place in the world, and we tend to underestimate our importance, which also means, our obligations, perhaps, but also the way that we interrelate with other countries. And the thing that I think is most worrying at the moment is what seems to have been a sudden collapse in confidence in our negotiations with the EU. You know, one hears over and over again, well, we have to wake up to reality, we have to realise that we're not very important anymore, we're really going to have to accept more or less everything that they demand because we're too weak to resist. And that is simply nonsense. And I think it's quite dangerous nonsense.
But Fraser, is it really nonsense that we're going to have to accept whatever EU leaders demand when we don't seem to be having a great start in negotiations, and it doesn't seem to be that Theresa May and her Brexit department are getting on particularly well? Indeed, they struggled to negotiate their deal with the DUP. It took them weeks, and that was relatively small compared to Brexit.
Oh yeah, it's certainly difficult to put too much of a gloss on our political situation. The best that can be said for British politics is that Jeremy Corbyn isn't Prime Minister. But we do have a Prime Minister who's lost her majority, who went to the country saying, back me, to help me thrash them in Brexit negotiations, and then they did the exact opposite. They moved support away from her. So it's very embarrassing for her. The negotiations are going to be tricky as well. But then again, you can look at what else is happening. For example, later on this month, we're about to start trade talks with America. This is something which was a dream for a long time. And informal talks are going to begin on the 24th. Now, that's pretty good. We're also seeing a lot of progress with the EU as well. We recently agreed that British troops are going to be spearheading the European Task Force after 2019, even after Brexit. So the military cooperation will go on after we leave the EU. We're looking at about opting into the EU arrangements on patent courts and even scientific and research funding and collaboration. Britain's been told that it's invited to be a part of that after we leave. So this country has a lot to offer that a lot of other people want. As a result, we're beginning to get quite constructive and quite encouraging deals and cooperations and agreements that are falling into place around us. What we're not getting is good political leadership, but Britain's future is not defined by the quality of chat on a sofa or from a Sunday morning interview, and thank God for that.
But I suppose it is affected when the government doesn't have enough power to be able to pass important pieces of social reform. So, Professor Toombs, do you really think things are improving across the board, including for those at the bottom of society in terms of educational opportunities, in terms of social mobility? Or are things actually quite static for a lot of people who are struggling?
It's always a slog. I mean, these things require constant effort. If you look around Europe, I think we're sort of in the middle. I think there are things that we could do better and ought to do better. I think there are improvements in state education, as far as I can tell, but it's still not as good as it ought to be, and it's not as good as in other countries. But I think, you know, these things are the normal stuff of everyday politics. At the moment, we have, above all, to get the Brexit negotiations right. And I agree with Fraser that we have a lot to offer. It's rather like a game of poker. We know how the EU tends to operate, which is to play a sort of long game and also to do a bit of brinkmanship. And negotiating with them, it seems to me, and I speak as a complete outsider on these things, is rather like playing poker. And you've got to stick to what you intend to do. You've got to work out what your real strengths are, and you've got to be willing to stick to it and keep your nerve. I hope we shall do that. But the signs are, as you suggested, of a certain amount of dithering. But yet what we want is perfectly simple. We want a free trade treaty with Europe, and that's always what we wanted. And we intend to leave the political organisation of the EU. That's perfectly clear. So in a sense, it seems to me that what our negotiating strategy is very simple. And when people say how complicated it is, I think this is being talked up. And as long as we can be quite clear what we do want, and not, it seems to me at least, I'd be interested to know what Fraser thinks about this, not encourage negotiators in the Commission to think that we can be pushed around and that we're weakening our position, then I don't see why we shouldn't get a very good outcome.
Is that possible, Fraser?
Yes, it's possible, but we have to believe it ourselves. And this is the great problem. I mean, right now, in my opinion, Britain could walk out of Brexit talks. We could rely on the WTO trade rules, which basically make it impossible for Britain to be punished by the EU in some kind of trade war. That means we'd be guaranteed an average tariff of 3%. You know, there's a good future waiting us no matter what. But in order to get the best deal out of the European Commission, we need to persuade them that we would be willing to walk away with no deal at all, and that this would not be a disaster, as Philip Hammond said it would be recently. Now, Liam Fox, the International Trade Secretary, takes a very different view on this. He was saying that Britain would be absolutely fine under WTO rules, because this is, after all, how we agree trade with our biggest partner, the United States. Now, if the British government had a little bit more self-confidence, and it was believing or was able to exude more the air of a country which has got lots to offer and could basically make it with or without a deal from the EU, we stand a far better chance of getting that deal. But if we do what David Cameron did, saying we're desperate, we need to sign a deal no matter how bad it is, then we will get, as David Cameron got, a pretty bad deal.
And Professor Toombs, finally, we've talked about how politicians assert themselves, but does there need to be a shift in British culture in the way that Brits learn to talk about themselves and their country for us to accept that we are greater than we think we are?
Yes, I think there's been a bit too much of a cringe. I mean, it's an interesting question as to why we have taken this attitude, I think, or at least many people, for quite a long time. And it's no doubt to do with the end of empire and the idea that we were once a very great nation and that we're not. I argue in my article that this is largely an illusion and to a very considerable extent a distortion. I'm not arguing at all that we should imitate Putin's Russia, but I do think we should be a little more confident in ourselves and in the country's ability to exist as an independent nation and also to chart a proper course in the world. That's what I think, where I think confidence is, as you suggest, very necessary. And I think it's something that politicians need to show and if necessary, convince themselves of too.
Robert and Fraser, thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I present the weekly books podcast, at which you'll hear lively discussions from the best and most interesting critics and writers and authors out there, from Charlotte Rampling to Daniel Dennett, all the way past to Michael Morpurgo. I very much hope you'll give us a try. Just search for Spectator Books on the iTunes store.
And in the months since the election, there has been a surge of attention paid to the political situation in Northern Ireland, thanks to Theresa May's pact with the DUP. In the magazine this week, Jenny McCartney suggests that next week's 12th of July parades will be broadcast to an enraptured British as a sign of Northern Ireland's continued sectarian issues. But is that really fair? And what do these festivities mean to locals? Jenny joins me now, along with Siobhan Fenton in Belfast. Jenny, could you just explain for an audience that's not fully familiar with some of the traditions in Northern Ireland what these celebrations are like?
Well, I suppose it would be a traditional celebration mainly carried out by the Orange Order, which is a Protestant organisation in Northern Ireland, to celebrate King William of Orange's victory over King James II's forces at the Battle of the Boyne in 1690. So we're going back some. But this has carried on for a very long time and has always been a source of interest to people in England who tend to view these as somewhat mystifying rites.
Are they any more mystifying, though, than the 5th of November is in England?
Well, I think it's just more widely understood. And also because of Ireland's sectarian history generally, and sometimes tension around parading, it's seen as much more confrontational than the 5th of November, because by some people, because the 5th of November is not really a live issue in English politics today, mm-hmm. whereas some of the issues raised by parading are still live issues in Northern Irish politics.
And Siobhan, you're currently in Belfast. Is there a sense that these celebrations will be different from in recent years?
I think so, absolutely. I think that because of the DUP being seen as sort of having this great victory and joining their partnership with the Conservatives, I think that means that a lot of people in the loyalist or more hardline unionist community in Northern Ireland will see that as having a stronger hold now in Northern Ireland and throughout the UK, and kind of having their position elevated. And I think as well, because of Brexit, we've seen that there's been a lot of a greater push among the Republican and nationalist community in Northern Ireland for a border poll, on potentially looking at uniting Ireland again because of Brexit. I think that obviously that's caused a lot of concern among the loyalist community here, and I think it's possible there'll be a particular show of strength because of that to try and push against any idea of a border poll and to show that, you know, that their British identity, as they would say it, is strong and is steadfast.
And Jenny, you say in your magazine piece this week that you fear that the thrill of examining the caricatures of DUP members is just going to increase when people in the UK press see these 12th of July celebrations. What is it about them that sort of contributes to this caricature that you write about?
Well, I think there are some questions that need to be asked about how it's changed. I mean, I grew up in the 70s and heaven knows there was violence aplenty. But the 12th commemorations were not as charged as they are now. So in one sense, this has travelled in a different direction, even though we now have peace in Northern Ireland of a kind. So I think it's interesting that when they do look over, there are some aspects of it that have gone pretty nuts, such as the enormous bonfires that are being built in places where really they shouldn't be built and where the civic authorities don't want them built. Enormous teetering pyres, which are a danger to the environment and sometimes to housing around it. So while I do think that you can have a cultural celebration, I think it also has to abide by civic norms, and something there is slipping away from those.
And Siobhan, these do sound very confrontational as events. Is that how they feel to those who don't attend?
I think that would definitely be the case. And I think just in terms of what Jenny has said, I think that it is the case that it's become perhaps more antagonistic and confrontational in recent years. Because I mean, I grew up in Belfast in the 1990s, and I think that my experience of the 12th July parades was generally very negative, because my experience of it was that I lived in an estate which was kind of mostly mixed people with mixed marriages between Catholics and Protestants, and a lot of our neighbours would be immigrants, and then the estate next door was a loyalist council estate, and they would have very large 12th July parades, and our kind of experience of that would be that they would march around what would be considered shared areas and, you know, be kind of dressed up in primarily sort of militaristic gear and shouting various slogans. And then at the end of the parades, they would come into our estate to urinate on what they considered to be the Catholic houses. And then as well, the bonfire which they had was always sort of positioned around the back of my family's house, because we're perceived as being a Catholic family, and so that the bonfire would always be there, which obviously would be very frightening for us, because we'd always worry about whether our house would go on fire. And I knew last year that two houses went on fire during a bonfire in Belfast, and the two houses were completely gutted. And I think that it is definitely a worry for people. I'm sure people who take part in the parades would see themselves as having a very different experience maybe than people who kind of live in the surrounding communities. But I find that my experience of the 12th of July was primarily seen as something that was intimidating and very frightening, because, you know, it was partly as well the kind of humiliation of men in their 50s and 60s coming over to urinate on your house. It's just quite, particularly when you're a young child, it can be quite a baffling thing. And we sort of wonder, you know, why do our neighbours kind of feel so strongly, you know, feel these things about us because of our kind of religion or perceived culture. And then as well the concern just about, you know, worrying about your safety if you know, houses can go on fire. And I think particularly as well that bonfires are getting bigger and bigger each year, and that they aren't really supervised. They're primarily people who will take any kind of bit of discarded wood or old sofas, and they create these huge pyres, and that they just go on fire, and there's very little oversight or any kind of, you know, health and safety involved in that. And so I think that, yeah, the experiences that people have perhaps on what we consider to be the other side would be very, very different from people who are involved. I don't doubt, you know, we wouldn't probably see this as intimidation. They're just celebrating their own culture. But I think it's, as is often the case in Northern Ireland, that it's very much a kind of two sides to the coin in terms of how people perceive it.
And Jenny, could you just explain the relationship between the DUP and these events? How closely linked are they officially?
Well, there's obviously a sort of cultural link. And I would say that while nobody would defend the behaviour that Siobhan's describing, in other areas, in rural areas, a lot of these parades still pass off without contention. The other thing that's worth saying is that in the mid-90s, Sinn Féin did have a policy of creating or exacerbating tension around the parades and making them more of an issue. And Gerry Adams in 97 was recorded saying that Drumcree, which is one of the greatest standoffs around parading, didn't happen by accident. It was the result of a lot of hard work. So there was a decision in Sinn Féin activism to make these more of a sectarian issue. And unfortunately, in many cases, loyalism fell right into the trap. And part of the problem was that the issue was made around territory and where Orange men could parade rather than restrictions on behaviour. And actually, I think there should have been a lot more attention to reining in any sectarian displays around these. But it's very difficult at the moment to argue that it's community friendly when there are these enormous bonfires, which are potential hazards, often to housing, also in Protestant areas. The placement of them is not always sectarian. In fact, they're more likely to occur in areas that would be seen as Protestant, where they pose an equal danger. And loyalist paramilitaries having become fairly powerful and unchallenged, then that becomes quite difficult for locals to speak out.
And so you say at the end of your piece that if the DUP doesn't soon show decisive leadership in facing down the flags, the fires and the casual glorification of paramilitary horrors, its own reputation will be devoured by it. So what does the DUP need to do?
Well, I think it just needs to stand up much more against sectarianism. It's partly a problem that's been intensified locally by elements of the peace process, whereby the thinking was that you have to bring paramilitaries into politics, into communities, often fed with very large grants and entrenched within communities, holding an awful lot of power. And I think people in Northern Ireland, public figures around both Republican and Loyalist paramilitaries, are fearful of challenging them, lest there be disturbances. So in a funny way, politics is still being held hostage by it.
Siobhan, do you agree with that?
I don't think I'd quite agree. I think it's worth pointing out that a lot of the time that Unionist politicians, particularly the DUP, will far from distancing themselves from the 12th of July, the Orange Order, but they'll kind of actively be involved in kind of sticking up tensions around that time. I mean, I've been to one 12th of July parade when I was as a journalist, just reporting on it a few years ago, and there were lots of members of the DUP either there marching or kind of cheering on from the sidelines. And I think that Jenny's right, that definitely, that particularly with this year, because of the DUP has been subject to so much more focus in light of their kind of deal with the Conservatives and their greater prominence in kind of UK-wide politics, I think that this could become a bit of a thorn in the side for the DUP. I think that they could be in for quite a bad, it'd be terrible PR for them once, I mean, presumably whenever we have these parades, you know, in the next week or so, that there almost certainly will be violent clashes. There are sort of riots every year and police officers are injured as well as protesters, and normally that doesn't really get much coverage in England and in the English media, and it's possible that that will, you know, have greater focus this year because of the DUP's greater prominence. Now, I think that it's something that for many years Northern Ireland has just been accepted as one of those things, and people here kind of, they don't like it, but there's almost this hope that the Loyalist community will kind of get bored of this, or it'll wind down, or that with population shifts people will be less interested and it will almost peter out naturally in a few generations' time. But I think that a lot of people in England too aren't familiar with this at all. They, you know, will suddenly be quite shocked about what's happening, and that it's possible that the DUP will face greater criticism in England really than they would face locally, and that could put more pressure on them to kind of distance themselves from the Orange Order and distance themselves from these kind of more hardline loyalist groups.
And finally, Jenny, how do you think the DUP have been responding to the greater levels of scrutiny that they now face in the UK press and in Parliament, actually, as a party?
Well, I think they would probably be conscious, as would other people in Northern Ireland, there's been quite a level of hysteria around it, and to some degree hypocrisy, given that Labour were trying to do a deal with them in 2010, and other parties hold similar views on abortion, which has not been often discussed. So there has been a lot of caricaturing, but I think now is the time for them to reveal that if they do have a more layered side, they have a responsibility to rein in some of the tribalism in Northern Ireland. And I don't think it means entirely abandoning traditions like the 12th, but I do think it means us strongly attempting to bring them within civic authority.
Thank you, Jenny and Siobhan.
Why wait for tomorrow's papers? The best analysis of the day's news is already on Coffee House. To subscribe to the Evening Blend email in order to receive the best of The Spectator each day, just head to spectator.co.uk/blend.
Meeting and greeting other men used to be so easy, says Matthew Bell in The Spectator this week. Not anymore, and it is all the fault of the man hug. It's time for someone to lay down the rules on male greetings once and for all. And to do just that, I'm joined by etiquette expert Liz Brewer and etiquette amateur Cosmo Landsman. So Liz, are handshakes going out of fashion?
Sadly, yes. Because the handshake, which traditionally was always the greeting, the formal greeting, and even the normal greeting, made life simple. What we've done is now we've created this minefield. Because you come up to someone and they meet you for the first time and they feel they have the right to invade your aura, your energy, and plonk a kiss on both cheeks, or one cheek, or three times. And I actually feel very awkward about it until I know someone. When you know someone, that energy starts to sort of gel and you feel comfortable. So what's happened is, especially with men and greeting, they've no idea what to do. I mean, first of all, fashionistas, they're
spoilt for choice now.
Well, it's not that they're spoilt for choice. Unless you're gay fashionista, or I was going to say European, but they feel they have absolutely the right to come up and hug you and kiss you on both cheeks, true, or three cheeks or whatever.
Well, that's what I mean. But what I mean by they have so many options now. In the old days, it was all very simple. Now the question is, what do you do? Do you high five? Do you bump fists? Do you do low five? Do you go in for the kiss?
Well, that's American.
Do you go in for the manhunt? But no, you find it more and more happening in metropolitan centers.
The bump is...
What do you do, Cosmo?
I like the fist bump. Now, I know...
fist bump?
The fist bump. I'll tell you what's wrong. No, it's catching on, the fist bump. Why it's a great thing is because it actually greets someone and it says them, stay there. Don't try and hug me. Don't try and kiss me. There.
But then
a little touch like that.
A handshake.
It's not embarrassing.
No, but a handshake does exactly the same. And when somebody comes up to me, I was watching to see if anybody was going to today come up
and
kiss me.
But the handshake is dead.
But they didn't. No.
It's like a bowler hat. Nobody does it anymore.
Absolutely not. I do a handshake. And when people come up and I know they're going in for that
full... You're old school. You're old school.
I may be old and it may be
old
school.
Not old school, not old.
But no, in my world, people still do that handshake. And what I do is I put out the arm and it stops them, because otherwise they're going to do literally a full frontal and I'm going to be embarrassed.
But the point, yeah, but the difficulties is when it's men kissing men, you see. This is a new
and
thing.
That's
it's not
what
just
this
a
piece
man hug.
Is about it. It's men going in for the big bear
yes.
hug.
It's
not just a bear hug.
It's the kissing.
Bear hug is the thing of the past. It's the kiss now. And what is happening, I've noticed now, is what I call the virtue kiss. It's when straight men want to kiss their gay friends smack on the lips to show them that they're not uptight, that they're not homophobic. It's a kind of it's a new thing I've witnessed that if you don't kiss a guy now like that, there's something
suspect.
So Cosmo,
what do you do?
I do the old fist bump.
You go
see,
like
it's
that.
I go
well,
like
that's
that.
Like
it's slightly punch. Ironic. It's slightly ironic because it's, you know, it evolves from Black urban culture, and when white people do it, it's always a little ridiculous. But I sort of give a big smile and go. Hey, like
so
that.
When you're at our summer party and you meet, I don't
By
know...
By the way, you don't do that. Don't try this at a spectator party or at home. No,
I was
I don't
going
do
to say when you meet the Prime Minister or when you meet the Chancellor, when you meet Philip Hammond, for instance, but would you really fist
handshake.
Bump him?
Handshake.
There you are, you see.
Not a man
the handshake has not gone out. It still may be considered formal, but it is still a greeting that is recognised.
Not with young people, though. Young people won't know what you're doing.
No,
if
no,
you
no.
put out a hand,
no, no, no.
They don't, you know.
Young people,
but this,
I
you
know,
train
do.
Young people,
absolutely.
Don't you,
absolutely. Yes. Yesterday, for example, and I was doing some filming, and it was very interesting because when I arrived, immediately the producers came up and grabbed me. And I said, actually, what we're doing at the moment is we're just introducing ourselves because I'm going to come in a room and I've got to pretend I know you. So we'll get over the introduction and then you don't have to do this kiss business with me while you're filming, because I honestly hate it. I loathe it. I just can't bear it. But when it comes to a handshake, I find now people are doing it more because I think I'm not the only one that absolutely objects to people invading my aura, my energy, until I know them.
How do they know when they have permission to enter your personal space?
You know, your subconscious...
Sounds like an airplane.
No, your subconscious. Now, you must be aware of that. Your subconscious tells you. When you walk in a room, you have that aura, you have that energy. You can have it, you know, photographed by, this special camera. And that energy is communicated.
But what about those of us who are less of a mystical nature and don't pick up on energies and those kind of signs?
Automatically,
don't you think
you
we
do.
Should have? We no longer live in that world, you know, that you, non your clearly defined world of social etiquette. So, you know, someone who cares, like, you should do what is appropriate to the situation.
You should do
so
what you
feel. So, if a handshake
feel.
Is appropriate to that particular
Precisely.
People,
Precisely.
Fine. But in some circumstances,
Absolutely.
That wouldn't necessarily.
But
no,
what
doubt.
Is
there
appropriate?
There is
appropriate's
a,
the word.
There is a problem here, isn't there? Which is that actually the rules have been relaxed to the extent that lots of people don't know what the rules are, and there are regional variations in the rules. So, for instance, if I meet someone I know in Westminster, I give them a double kiss. When I'm in the Northwest, where I spend a lot of time, if I gave someone a double kiss, they'd call me fancy. And so actually you have to know where you are when
well, you
you're
see, you're spot on.
Somebody.
Rules have changed and we have gone into the 21st century. However, when it comes to social behaviour, there are guidelines and there are, exactly as Cosmo said, it's what feels right. And you have to rely on your subconscious to know, okay, this person I feel like greeting. You know, it's either a very close friend or it's family or it's somebody, you know, you may have met a couple of times. You have to rely on your own judgment and make the right decision.
How do you correct an awkward moment? So someone's gone in for
the
hug.
Full frontal.
You were going in for a handshake. Mm-hmm. You end up hitting their stomach. They're kissing your neck. Everything's horrendous. What do you do to diffuse the horrendous tension of the situation apart from running away?
Well, what you can do is you have to have eye contact and you have to smile, but you just quite firmly hold them here by the shoulders and
self-defense believer.
Yeah, well, that's what I do.
The way to solve this whole problem of greeting confusion is you've got to take the initiative and establish the narrative, as it were, the greeting narrative. You've got to get out there and say, whip out the hand first, or if you want to do the kiss, do the... You establish... It's like dancing. You take the lead and bring them
you
on.
You can do
Otherwise,
that.
Otherwise, you get into too much confusion.
You can do that if you're a strong character, and you are. But there are lots of people who aren't, and those are the people who literally shudder. And with them... What do you do? What do those people... All we can do is say, literally, make some space.
Back off.
Thank you, Liz and Cosmo, for that. And that's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including Holy Smoke, where this week Damien Thompson and Christina Adoni were joined by Peter Tatchell to discuss religious attitudes to homosexuality. And if you enjoy the podcasts, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed on this podcast, as well as great pieces by Susan Hill, Jessica Behrens, and Damien Riley. And we have a special offer for podcast listeners. 12 issues for £12 and a limited edition Spectator Moleskine notebook if you subscribe at spectator.co.uk/podoffer. Thanks for listening and do join us again next week.